They say we have put so much carbon into the atmosphere that it's causing Earth's climate to change. We must do something, or else. And so we ask, can we capture the carbon we emit and sequester it on our farms?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1275th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Brisbane who are tuned into the podcast as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. But whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, they do say that we have to do something about all the carbon we are putting up into the atmosphere. Or else what? Well, nobody really says or else what, but they leave it to our imagination, and that makes us cringe. I recently had an occasion to see some satellite images of China that lent credence to the or else. The images did not show much of China, except for a narrow slice of terrain that might well have been Western Mongolia. What the images did show was a thick gray-brown layer of soot covering almost the entirety of the Middle Kingdom. Some say China now emits more airborne pollution than all the other countries in the world combined. Don't believe it. That pollution belongs to us. We pay good money for it. In fact, we've just about spent our nation's entire life savings on it and are stealing from the future to buy more of it. Now, it seems to this Montana boy that the simplest, most cost-effective way to cut down on all that carbon we are putting up in the atmosphere is to stop buying made in China and start buying made in the USA. After all, there are no belching smokestacks allowed here. It would be very simple and easy, and it would even keep us from becoming another Venezuela. But our leaders are proposing a different way of managing carbon. During a recent address to a joint session of Congress, President Joe Biden proposed paying farmers to sequester carbon in their soil. It is an interesting proposal. Farmers would do what farmers have always been paid to do, which is to grow crops for food. But instead of throwing away the residue of their crops, farmers would sequester it in their farm soil. By this sequestration, farmers would prevent carbon from escaping into the atmosphere. This is where the politician's proposal gets very interesting. Farmers would count the carbon they sequestered in their soil and sell credits to it on a USDA-approved carbon credit exchange. Companies that do a lot of polluting would then be able to buy those credits and count them against the pollution they emit. In this exchange, a company that does a lot of polluting would be able to claim itself to be net zero. Farmers would get a lot of money for doing what farmers have always done, and the climate would stop changing and the earth would live happily ever after. And so we ask, can we capture the carbon we emit and sequester it on our farms? Well, who better to ask than Ben Lulliston, who is the Director of Rural and Climate Strategies at the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. Ben, welcome to the Food Chain.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me.
Well, good. Before we move on down the road, I'm deeply troubled by that satellite image of what I saw of China. What troubles me is that I'm coming to think that China, that pollution does not belong to China. It belongs to us because we're paying for it. We have chased our industry out of the country because it's dirty, and then we run down to the box store and buy made in China because it's cheap. And so I'm troubled by the fact that China's air pollution really is our air pollution. Now, am I wrong?
It's certainly a portion of it is. I mean, that is a big debate internationally is if you are importing a lot of goods, who's responsible for the climate emissions associated with the production of those goods? And I think you're right that we have offshored a lot of our manufacturing and some of the other sectors towards other countries, including China, and in doing so, offshored our pollution. So that is a big debate taking place right now. And that is one of the defenses that China gives, which is that, hey, you know, we're supplying all these goods, we're going to have more pollution for the rest of the world.
And they're building scores of new coal-burning power plants to do that job.
That's right.
So
that's right.
It's just going to keep getting worse and worse and worse. But what really upsets me is that we seem to feel better and better and better about ourselves because we're so clean and they're so dirty, and it just doesn't seem right.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, this is really one of the arguments for why we need a global sort of cooperation in dealing with climate change, because it is a global problem. And each country sort of left to their own devices, you can have a situation like this where some countries are polluting a lot more than others. And so it is an argument for, and in some ways we're paying the price a bit for the Trump administration sort of completely leaving global discussions on climate change. And so we need to get back in there, and we need to think about how to work together. There are, you know, discussions about how can other countries account for climate emissions in global trade? Mm-hmm. And how can you tilt the playing field towards countries that are reducing emissions or meeting their Paris Climate Agreement commitments? So it's a feverish international debate, and there's enormously high stakes.
What if we just put a carbon tax on everything? You know,
and, well,
for every widget that came from China, there would be a carbon tax.
That is one of the big issues that is on the table. Europe right now is advancing that particular approach around a carbon, what they call a carbon tariff on imports. And that would be if a country is not meeting their standards for production, which are reducing emissions, then they would place a carbon tariff on those imports. And they're particularly focused on certain sectors, steel, more energy intensive sectors, but they also include fertilizer and something that they're looking at, which intersects with agriculture and food. But yeah, you're right. That is an option that countries are really looking at right now. Biden administration has mentioned that particular mechanism before as something that they would consider.
So that would be a tough sell to a lot of the industrialists of America who have picked up their factories here in the United States and moved them to China. And I mean, if we had to put a carbon tax on iPhones, holy smokes, there would be a lot of hooting and hollering going on, I suspect, from all of those people who own Apple stocks here in the United States. But at any rate, you are the director of Rural and Climate Strategies for the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. That's a lot. What is the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy?
Yes, it's not the most catchy name, but you know, we were formed in the 1980s around the farm crisis. We're based here in Minnesota. We also have an office in D.C., but also an office in Germany, Berlin. And so we work locally, nationally, and internationally. When we were formed, it was during that farm crisis, and people were trying to understand what are some of the global factors and policies that are driving this farm crisis.
Yeah, Ben, before you go on, I'll bet there are a lot of people listening today that don't know what the farm crisis was. Could you give us a thumbnail?
Yeah, I mean, during the 80s, there were massive farm-level foreclosures. And basically, prices that farmers were paid were dropped, and we lost a lot of small and mid-sized farmers, particularly in the Midwest. And a lot of this was a result of several decades of farm policy, which really encouraged massive production. And when you start to overproduce for the market, prices go down. And there was also huge issues with the way the U.S. Department of Agriculture was running its credit program. And farmers getting into debt and then having to file for bankruptcy. So it was a serious rural crisis affecting farmers all over the country. And there were a lot of organizations that sort of came out of that. I don't know if people may remember Farm Aid. It's still going on now.
Willie Nelson.
The first Farm Aid was during that crisis and designed to how can we help farmers who are really struggling, and it continues to today.
Well, you know, looking back on it, it appears to have been a period, the farm crisis could be equated to a period of great consolidation, because I would suspect the average size of the American farm grew immensely, because a lot of very small and medium-sized farms simply were subsumed into much larger farms.
That's correct. Yeah, I mean, land consolidation in agriculture has been pretty steady over these last three or four decades. It's just getting more and more consolidated. So that means fewer landowners, that means fewer farmers in a particular county. And this is why we're also losing population in a lot of rural communities. Our overall farmer numbers are going down. Now, there's a lot of new and beginning farmers stepping in. But they're struggling to get access to land because of this sort of land control and consolidation.
Which I think is going to play into our conversation about the administration's and Congress's idea for carbon sequestration in farmland. Do you see that as something that might pop up in this conversation today?
Yes, absolutely. It is very much, at least part of the discussion is around who would benefit from such a market, who can access it and who can't.
Yeah, there you go. So, and you are a director of the Rural and Climate Strategy. So somehow those two got woven together, rural and climate strategies. Are they the same or different?
Well, you know, we come at this that rural communities have a particular perspective and set of conditions around climate change. There are a lot of natural resource-based economies, and of course, farming is one of them. So they're experiencing climate change directly. It's affecting their business and how they operate. But it's also, in the case of farming or in the case of forestry, they have the potential to sequester carbon, and we'll dig into this as well. As well as really managing land is going to be a big part of adapting to climate change, managing water in particular, whether it's drought or whether it's heavy downpours. And so we see sort of rural communities and particularly farmers at sort of on the front lines of the climate crisis and really critical for how we're going to respond to the climate crisis.
There you go, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, this is the 1275th edition of the Food Chain Radio Program. With us today, Ben Lilliston. And we're trying to come to grips with the question, can we capture the carbon we have emitted and sequester it in our farm soil, and thereby save the earth? Right back.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, I'm always amazed when I see video of the rock star or the movie star or the politician that flew their private jet across the world to go to a climate change conference. And somebody says, well, don't you feel a little silly flying halfway around the world to this climate change conference on a jet that's emitting all that carbon? And the movie star or the rock star or the politician will say, well, no, it's okay because we offset our carbon emissions by buying some credits from somebody else. I always scratch my head at that and think, well, that carbon is still in the air, regardless of whether they got the credits or not. I don't know, how do those rock stars ring to you, Ben Lilliston?
Yeah, it doesn't ring true. But this is where this has come from. One of the dominant forms of climate policy, you know, going back over the last 10, 15 years has been something called cap and trade, where you basically set a cap for reducing emissions. And this is what California has. This is what Europe has. But within that, if you are a polluter, you can offset some of your emissions. So you can say, I'm going to buy a carbon credit from a renewable energy type of operation, or it could be a land-based credit. So it could be around forestry or agriculture, where they have determined that some amount of carbon has been sequestered. But, you know, from what we've seen, the evidence is pretty clear. This particular approach does not actually reduce emissions. And that's what we need to be heading towards, is not just trading off. Even if you feel like everything is working within those systems and they haven't worked well, there's been a lot of problems. But we need to be reducing emissions, and we feel like this approach really does it sort of what you were hinting at in telling that story. It allows the polluter who's responsible for the emissions to keep polluting and sort of pay their way out of it. And we really need to be digging in on those polluters, and they need to be figuring out how to reduce their own emissions. And we feel like that should be the crux of climate policy, as well as sort of these, what we would call more public relations, you know, kind of gambits around offsets.
And of course, the simplest way for them to really reduce their emissions is just to pick up and move to China or someplace else, which is what they've been doing over the last 20 years. So somehow we have to come to grips with cornering in a way that they would actually reduce their climate emissions rather than just greenwash everything, which is what they appear to be doing now. So Congress has come up with a new thing called Growing Climate Solutions Act, which is a mouthful in itself, but how does that differ from cap and trade?
Well, so right now there are voluntary carbon markets. So here you have some farmers being able to get verified that they have sequestered a certain amount of carbon, and then there are intermediaries who will sell that carbon credit to polluters. And it's entirely voluntary. Farmer can, you know, decide to do it or not. And a company can decide to purchase those pollution credits or not. So, for example, Microsoft is a big purchaser of theirs. They want to show to their shareholders and the public, hey, look, we're reducing emissions. McDonald's is another company that's interested in this. And that's entirely voluntary. There's no requirement that those companies do that. And we feel like that's, you know, partly revealing that it's kind of a public relations move rather than something more serious. But the Growing Climate Solutions Act would say, right now there's a bunch of different rules around these private carbon markets. There's no rules, basically. Each company sort of makes their own determination about methodology, what it looks like to actually sequester carbon. And they want to set one set of rules for how that private carbon market would work, that voluntary carbon market. And that's what the, and they want to house that at the USDA. And they want the USDA to sort of be in charge for setting the rules.
You know,
and
this so is, this is, yeah, this, Ben, this is very reminiscent of the word organic, which essentially meant nothing until such time as the organic farmers gave the word over to the USDA for safekeeping. And then it developed its very specific guidelines for what could or could not be considered organic, at which time a lot of big companies started petitioning USDA and say, hey, I want to play too. Do you see that same kind of thing developing here with this voluntary carbon credit exchange?
Well, it could. I mean, there's numerous problems here. At least in organic, you know, there is third-party certification
right
around those standards. And the standards-making process is very, you know, public and open, hotly debated. I think you've probably had some shows about that. And here, this is more, the USDA creates a website, the certifiers self-certify. It's a lot looser, and we would argue, and one of the reasons it's really loose is because actually certifying carbon credits on land is very difficult and challenging.
Ah.
And from a scientific standpoint, we don't actually know how much carbon is sequestered from year to year, and particularly when you start to look at over 10 years, over 20 years. And well, we don't...
Let's stop for a minute and back up and define exactly what that means. How do you sequester carbon in farm soil?
Yeah. So primarily it's about, you know, pulling carbon out of the air, usually through plants. And so whatever you happen to be growing. And so a lot of times when they talk about what are good systems for sequestering carbon, a lot of times it's perennial systems. So like grazing land, for example. So that's one way to get the carbon into the ground. This different practices like not tilling as much or completely no-till also is part of that, because when you till the soil, it re-releases the carbon into the air that you've just pulled out. And so those are the types, you know, types of practices that they're talking about when they talk about sequestering carbon.
Okay.
Basically, carbon is important, is at least one important part of soil, building soil health and soil organic matter. So it's not that it's something we want to encourage, right? We want people to be focusing on soil health. It really helps to withstand climate impacts. And it can help in your productivity.
Now, are you familiar with a F.H. King, who was once the Secretary of Agriculture for the United States? And at the turn of the last century, he went to China and came back and wrote a book called Farmers of 40 Centuries. And and that's exactly what he talked about, was how those farmers of 40 centuries have been sequestering carbon and other materials in the soil and thus maintaining soil fertility. So is sequestering carbon different than what farmers have been doing since the beginning of time?
No, it's not uniquely different, but it's just one part of a farming system. It's a very narrow way of looking at it. And I would say that one of the real threats we have right now in our farming system is the loss of soil, you know, soil depletion, because we're using a lot of chemicals, a lot of fertilizer, some cases growing the same crop over and over, so corn on corn, or just two crop rotation, corn and soybeans, and not really having that more healthier soil where you would have multiple crop, you know, maybe a five crop rotation as organic encourages, or looking at perennial crops. So when you start to build those longer root systems and really build overall soil health, So carbon is, we view it as kind of a really narrow way to view it. But you raise an important point here, which is that there are farmers who have been doing really good, sustainable agroecological practices for quite a while. They have been sequestering carbon. But the way that these carbon markets work is that it's only new carbon that you've sequestered that you can count as a credit. And so you don't get any credit or reward for what you've done in the past. And there are limits to how much carbon you can sequester. Like it's not the same rate, the same amount year after year. So in some ways, farmers that have been doing the right thing are punished a little bit in the way that these markets would be set up. Also, they primarily want large-scale operations. So one of the carbon market certifiers requires a 1,000-acre operation. So that takes out a lot of other farmers, smaller scale. If you have a particularly diverse operation, moving animals around and so forth, that could create some problems in how they measure it. There's a lot of scientific uncertainty and agriculture uncertainty when you just are looking at one narrow thing.
Mm-hmm. So, which is that narrow thing is the element carbon, which of course is only one element in many that get put back into the soil if you're doing biologically intense cultivation practices. And that seems to be one of the objections to this whole notion is from people like you who are saying this seems to be benefiting only those kinds of agriculture that we're trying to get away from on some element, which is to say large monocropping systems. Now, we understand from what we've read that the most of these carbon credits being purchased by organizations like Microsoft and McDonald's and Bayer AG come from carbon credits that were derived from 1,300-acre farms. So very, very big monocropping operations like corn. So how exactly does McDonald's take advantage of these credits then?
Well, what they'll do is in their sustainability reports, you know, they'll say we are responsible for a certain number of greenhouse gas emissions, but we've purchased, you know, 1,000 of these carbon credits. So our total emissions actually are 1,000 credits less than what we've actually emitted. Okay. So they're using it to try to lower their carbon footprint. And, you know, we just feel like this is not a legitimate sort of methodology. They need to be focusing on their own emissions. What's happening on that farm, and this is another really important point, is that it does have to be permanent. You know, if you go and till up that land in 5 years, in 10 years, you've released the carbon that you've already sequestered back into the environment, and it makes that what McDonald's, you know, bought meaningless.
So let's say McDonald's goes and buys 1,000 tons of carbon credits from a corn and soybean farm in the Midwest, and they pay the money for it, and the corn and soybean farmer, you know, somehow gets his crop residue back into the soil, I guess tills it in. How else do you do it? But that carbon is locked into the soil, so it has to stay there for the carbon credit to be valid, right?
I mean, that's right. Yeah.
So it has it has to stay in the soil. Otherwise, whatever McDonald's paid for it, it becomes invalid.
That's right. And a lot of the sort of corn and soy, what they are arguing is that no-till. So a lot of them do no-till, and that's, you know, heavily chemically intensive. Yeah. A lot of GMO. But
tell people what that means. Tell people how no-till works.
Well, so no-till is just a way of farming where you're not going deep at the end of your harvest to till up the soil again to plant again. And you're just taking off and harvesting what you need, and often you'll leave a little bit of the residue on the land, and then go back, you know, and plant again into that same soil. So it's not, again, you're not going deep in your tillage each year, and which is sort of a way of dealing with weeds traditionally, is you would go and just till up the whole land. And there are different levels of tilling, you know, so you can do, you know, kind of a short till or a deep till or no-till. And so there is some argument that no-till helps sequester carbon more than sort of a conventional approach. Okay. And a lot of times no-till is coupled with GMO crops and pesticides and some fertilizer use.
So that means that the carbon that's being sequestered through no-till agriculture, which is pretty cool if you think about it, except for the fact that the farmers have to use a lot of chemicals to get the job done. They have to kill everything and knock it back. And so so the carbon that gets sequestered there has to stay there for it to be of value to the companies that are paying big bucks for this carbon sequestration. Because if the farmer goes back and sticks a plow into the field and plows up the soil, why, that carbon escapes back into the atmosphere. And so the whole Ponzi scheme kind of falls apart. Well, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. And we are honored today to have Ben Lilliston, who is the Director of Rural and Climate Strategies for the Institute of Agriculture and Trade Policy. The question, can we capture the carbon we emit and sequester it on our farms? Right back.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Polyface Farms, Joel Salatin.
Few how-to books could be more appropriate for our times than MetroFarm, a truly comprehensive manual. MetroFarm makes the whole embedded food system doable. It's a must-read.
USDA Director Bud Kerr.
Big book. MetroFarm describes the agronomic, economic, and managerial concepts required to generate substantial profits from agricultural locales near metropolitan areas.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning MetroFarm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
Duke the Pug will soon turn 20, which is pretty good for a dog breed that averages 11 years. When Duke was 13, he lost a lot of hair, had a hard time getting up for a walk, and his bowel movements were not very moving. We started making his food instead of buying it. We cook up a big batch of rice, chicken, broccoli, carrots, and turmeric, freeze meal-sized batches, and thaw them at mealtime. We also sprinkle Arthrodex on each meal. Arthrodex is a complete blend of plant-derived minerals, vitamins, amino acids, and enzymes formulated to make old dogs young again. And it does. Duke the Pug does have his problems, but he has all his hair, loves daily walks, and has no problems with his movements. Breakfast is at 7, and if it's not there by 7:01, we all hear about it. Make your old dog young again. Pick up Arthrodex at NutriensToGo.com. And while you're at it, make yourself young again with a Healthy Body Start Pack. NutriensToGo.com. NutriensToGo.com.
History buffs. This tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place in Bremerton, Washington, August 1944.
Bremerton was the best Liberty port of the war, and I had a secret weapon for enjoying every second of it. Roller skates. No kidding. Now, right outside the gates of the base was a sailor bar, and almost every sailor would stop right there, but not me. I kept right on going till I get to the roller rink. Most of the guys thought I was nuts, but I wasn't. You see, there was no better way to meet girls than to skate around in a rink in your dress blues. Back in those days, I was limber enough to do tricks like wrapping one leg around my neck while I was skating on the other. Yeah, most of the guys thought I was crazy. They'd see me leaving the base with my skates and just shake their heads, but heck, I laughed all the way to the bank.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com. Talesfromatincan.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back, folks. This is The Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What? And I guess what's eating what right now is the pollution that we are emitting into the atmosphere. Had a chance to look at some satellite pictures of China and was just absolutely stunned at the extent to which pollution covers that entire country like a big, thick blanket. My heart goes out to those Chinese people. But it's not the Chinese fault, I don't think. I think it's our fault because we're paying China to do that to themselves. And we're paying them good money. And we're paying them all our money when it gets right down to it. So how are we going to come to grips with this notion of pollution? We chase our industry away because it's dirty. And then we run down to the box store and buy made in China because it's cheap. And it's just not working. As a matter of fact, one-fifth of the world's biggest corporations have pledged to become net zero greenhouse gas emitters. What does net zero mean, Ben Lilliston?
Yeah, that means, so it's important to understand that's not real zero. That is reducing your emissions to a certain level, but then sequestering carbon to reach zero. So if you reduce emissions by 70%, finding another 30% of supposedly sequestered carbon. There's also talk about carbon capture technology where they sort of pull it out of the air and bury it to get to zero emissions.
They actually do that? It's like a big vacuum cleaner they stick up in the atmosphere?
Well, there's a lot of research going on around that sort of those kinds of high-tech solutions. Mm-hmm.
So, at any rate, everybody's very concerned about it because we're beating ourselves up all the time about it. We have to do something or else the Earth will... Or else what, Ben?
Well, we're just going to see more and more climate instability and weather, extreme weather events. You know, we have this severe drought right now going on out west. We get these extreme storms, hurricanes hitting big parts of the United States, particularly in the southwest, southeast, rising sea levels are issues with a lot of cities. So it's fairly urgent. The science says within the next, by 2030, we really need to be on a path to dramatically reducing emissions.
Okay. Well, one of the paths being offered up by the politicians in Washington, D.C. is to institute the Growing Climate Solutions Act, wherein we establish a voluntary carbon credit exchange monitored by USDA, in which companies, big companies like Microsoft and McDonald's and Bayer AG could buy carbon credits from farmers who have sequestered it in their soil. And that way, the climate will stop changing and the Earth will live happily ever after. But something tells me that this program really will do what most all programs have always done, which is benefit those who have the economies of scale to have the size sufficient to benefit from it. Now, how much is a ton of carbon worth on the climate exchange?
Well, right now it does vary, but it's somewhere between $15 to $20 a carbon credit that a farmer can take in. So right now it's not very much, and most farmers feel like it's not enough to really cover the changes that they have to make in their farming system to get that credit. That's one of the reasons that it's really attractive for polluters, because it's a cheap way, relatively cheap way, to make it appear as if you're reducing your own pollution when in fact you're not. You're just buying really cheap credits.
Mm-hmm. You know, it occurs to me that it's a real good deal for polluters because you can buy the carbon credits, deduct them from your pollution, and then greenwash your name and tell everybody how handsome and good you are for the environment, when in all actuality, you haven't done a thing except continue polluting. Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong. That's exactly the crux of our concern. And, you know, we continually point out, you know, a lot of the high pollution areas of this country are in communities of color. So this is a big environmental justice issue. And really, environmental justice communities have been the ones saying this offset approach, this kind of carbon credit approach, is not the way to go. And they've been pushing for how do we regulate the industry. And one of the ways that we've been talking about is we have a lot of really good public programs, particularly conservation programs, that could really help farmers make some of these transitions towards building up the soil health, bringing a lot of sort of cleaning water, and doing a lot of other benefits for conservation. Let's invest in those rather than getting distracted by this carbon market offset approach.
Can you give us an example of how those programs would help?
Yeah, so for there are several different conservation programs. One is the Conservation Reserve Program, where we have a lot of farming done on marginal farmland. In other words, land that actually is not that productive, probably shouldn't be farmed. But farmers have the equipment, they have the seed, so they just go and plant on it. And so Conservation Reserve Program helps farmers take that land out of production for a period of time, helps them restore it to whether it's a prairie, whether it's another type of more natural habitat. And that helps in turn, that will help sequester some carbon. There's the Conservation Stewardship Program, which is a working lands program that helps farmers develop a whole conservation plan for their farm. And there they can look at cover crops, they can look at more perennial grasses or other types of perennial crops on their land. They can diversify their whole rotations. If they are interested in bringing livestock onto the land, it can help with fencing and those kinds of infrastructure things. So these programs are super popular among farmers. I mean, they oversubscribe, meaning more farmers apply for those programs than they have money available. And we feel like really amping up the availability and accessibility of those kinds of programs would give us a pretty big benefit from a climate perspective. I guess the last point I would say is these programs are accessible to all farmers, so not just big operations, but also small-scale operations. And so if we can improve those programs and expand their access, we feel like that's the way to go.
It would seem like those programs would be more likely to benefit smaller operations than the large monocrop systems that we have developed that throughout the Midwest.
Absolutely, yeah. Any size farm can apply for most of those programs. And you can be a diverse type of program operator too, you know, not just growing one or two crops. So it's definitely more accessible for small and mid-size, and they have particular carve-outs too for farmers of color to make sure that they can access those programs.
Now, it seems to me over the watching agriculture very intently over the course of the last few years that I've seen agriculture grow in size, farms and ranches grow in size, because farmers are astute at taking advantage of federal programs, subsidies and whatnot. And the more acres you have, or the greater size you have, the greater the benefit of these farm programs. So it's a great way, these programs tended to be, a great way for a few people to get very, very big. And the bigger they get, the more they benefit. So if carbon's worth $15 a ton, and you have a 100-acre farm, you're not going to do what it takes to sign up with any federal program that would make you jump through all those hoops to enroll, are you? You're going to, but if you have, you know, 10,000 acres, you got a nice paycheck on the deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's definitely some economies of scale for larger operators to access these markets. I mean, you have to cover certification costs, for example, like somebody has to come out and check everything out. It's easier to kind of lower those costs per credit if you're a larger scale operation. And I think you're right. Most smaller scale operators are not going to be, it's just not going to make sense for them. Whereas the conservation, public conservation programs would.
Mm-hmm. One thing that popped into, you know, my field of vision here recently was the whole notion of a digital agriculture economics. Have you ever heard of that before?
Well, there's a lot of talk about digital agriculture, and it means a lot of things. So I'm not sure exactly what you're referring to.
I think it was relating to the whole notion of a carbon credit system. So maybe, I have no idea how you account for all of this, this notion. You're a McDonald's, you're Microsoft, you're Bayer AG. I guess you'd have to set up some kind of accounting system. Maybe that's what they're talking about. When it gets right down to it, Ben Lilliston, is this reducing the amount of carbon we emit into the atmosphere?
It's not reducing what we emit. That's for sure. And that's kind of the central, you know, what we think should be the focus. It is pulling some, it could pull some carbon into the ground, but for how much and for how long is a real open question. And the science continues to evolve about that. We don't feel like it's anywhere close to being clear enough to establish a carbon credit and allow polluters to go that route.
I wonder how you actually measure how much carbon one sequesters into the soil. Do you take out a shovel and dig down a foot? But what about everything under a foot? Or do you take what you found in the first 6 inches and extrapolate that to the next 6 feet of soil? It seems like there's a lot of ways one could put a thumb on the scale on this deal.
There's a lot of guesswork around it, for sure. And, you know, anybody who's been on, you know, on a farm can talk about how the soil, you know, the soil type and quality and shifts even within an existing farm, let alone, say, within different parts of our state. In Minnesota, we have, you know, very different soil in the northern part of the state to the southern versus different parts of the country. And that is one of the criticisms is that some parts of the country just don't sequester enough, just can't, the way that their topography is set up to even access these markets. So there's just such a wide variance. And the other thing is that the weather itself affects your ability to sequester carbon. And if you get a flood in your farm, that could wipe out whatever you've sequestered before, or a wildfire comes through. Those kinds of changes can also affect your soil carbon sequestration. An investment in soil health is good, and let's focus on that. And it will sequester some carbon over time, but we don't need to turn it into a credit.
Well, Ben Lilliston, this whole thing, it looks to me like it allows the very big polluters to keep right on polluting, the very big farms to keep right on getting rich by farming the government, and the climate to keep right on changing. You're the director of the Rural and Climate Strategies for the Institute of Agriculture and Trade Policy. What makes sense to you?
I think we need to take a couple approaches. One is really investing much deeper into these conservation programs, make them accessible to any farmer who wants to access them. And you have to qualify, and there are some hoops you'd have to run through to make that happen, but they're all accessible and possible, and that's something USDA can improve on, is making it accessible to everyone. But let's get some more resources in there. I think we'll see immediate, not only benefits from a sequestration standpoint, but as important, being able to adapt to climate change. We need And we know we need more diversity within our farming systems, and that diversity helps build resilience when it comes to climate. So let's focus on that. The other area, though, that we haven't talked about is, from an agriculture standpoint, there are several clear sources of emissions. One is these large-scale factory farms, particularly hog and dairy operations that liquefy their manure. So I'm not talking about the smaller scale operations, particularly in dairy, but these mega farms that have large amounts of liquefied manure in these manure lagoons, they're a major source of methane and nitrous oxide emissions. And then fertilizer and synthetic fertilizer is also another major source of emissions. So we need to be looking at how can we limit those. And honestly, we're probably going to have to go regulatory route because as long as those particular parts of farming are able to evade regulation, it's going to be tough.
And that's for where we're at. Well, yep, Ben Lilliston, we're out of time here, but I want to thank you so much for joining us today and shedding some light on this incredibly complex notion of sequestering carbon. Ben Lilliston, Director of Rural and Climate Strategies, Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy up there in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.